Today's episode is sponsored by Hop Culture Mats. Keep listening for your chance to win a set of Oasis-themed beer mats.
All right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. I hope you guys are okay. And if you're in the UK enjoying the first few days of being able to get out and about again, get a haircut, go and have a beer, go to the shops, all that sort of stuff that we've been missing for the last few months. It's been a bit weird, isn't it? But anyway, today on the Oasis podcast, we've got some good fun. We've got kind of a bit of a two-parter. I did an interview with Alan McGee the other day, and the main thing I did was counted down the top 20 Creation Records and Pop Tones albums as voted for by Oasis podcast Twitter followers. And we did that. That went out on Barrel House Radio on my Oasis podcast radio show over there. If you haven't checked that out, it is now up on Patreon, or it is on Mixcloud if you don't put your money where your mouth is. The links are in the episode below. But as well as that, I also caught up with Alan about Creation Stories, and we had a good chat about that. I just had a quick chat with him about Charlotte, Le Volume Curb, actually, because I'd never talked to him about that before, and the fact that he had given her a first break. So I touched upon that as well. But then that was only sort of 10 minutes or so. So the main thing we're doing today is catching up with our old mate, Richard Bowes. Richard wrote the book about Oasis that we helped put out with the Some Might Say, and he's done a new book on The Verve, part of the Modern Music Masters series that Tom Boniface Webb, who came on here, he was talking about Blur and Oasis. And they've done five of those now, and I've got a copy. It's really cool. I am sort of considering getting the whole set now as well, just because I think it would look really nice together on the shelf. So definitely check out that book, and I hope you guys enjoy the interview. We are talking all about The Verve and Oasis, their different run-ins, and just generally our views on The Verve. It's good fun chat, cool music interspliced, so all good, and I hope you guys enjoy it. As I mentioned at the start, today's episode is sponsored by Hop Culture Mats. They are at hopculture_mats on Twitter. And as you might guess, they make sort of cool pop culture themed beer mats. And the set that we are giving away is a set of Oasis themed beer mats that are super cool. They've sent me a set, and they just really cool. The designs are awesome. Each design is different to a specific song, and they just look great. They look really cool. I really don't want to actually put wet pint pots on them. I think I'll stick them in a frame and put them up on the wall, because they look really, really great. But anyway, you can be in with a chance of winning one. What you got to do, you got to be following me at Oasis Podcast, and you got to be following at hopculture_mats on Twitter. And I want you to tweet at me with your best Oasis and alcoholic drink pun. So some sort of alcoholic drink related to an Oasis song or Oasis member, something like that. Pass me down the wine would be the most obvious thing, but come on, you can do better than that. So get in touch with one of those. What I'll do, the four best I'll put to a poll, and the winner of the poll wins the set of mats. So yeah, do get in touch, and I really look forward to reading your entries. Right, we have some news in the world of Oasis, which is quite interesting. The listing for Record Store Day later this year in June has been announced, and Noel Gallagher has got an LP coming out. That's all we know, because at the moment it's just down as TBA. Obviously, speculation is then rife on the forums and on Twitter and everywhere else over what it could be. I'm guessing it's the EPs from last year or last couple of years collected, with maybe We're Going to Get There in the End to make it kind of 10 tracks. I would imagine it's that. It could be a remix LP, which I wouldn't really fancy, but yep, could be that. I know there's been rumours of him putting out a greatest hits, because it's, you know, it's been 10 years since the debut album came out. And, you know, he's had enough songs to have a greatest hits under High Flying Birds, so it could be that. But yeah, we shall see. In fact, we may even know by the time you listen to this. But right now, as of the evening of the 12th of April, we haven't got a clue. So that will be interesting to find out. Oh, one other thing to talk about, actually, is that we have a really cool community on the Oasis Podcast Patreon and on Discord. And so it's like a private sort of WhatsApp group, really, for members of the Oasis Podcast Patreon. And yeah, and there's some very talented musicians on there. A few months ago now, one of the guys on there, Mike, said, well, why don't we do like a little band project and do a cover version or something like that. Obviously all remote, and just record stuff and ping it all together. And yeah, we did. So a bunch of people have contributed to this, including drums by Will Harvey, bass by Paul Costello, guitar and vocals by Dave Walker, vocals from PJ Paul, vocals and guitar from Carl Might Say, guitar from Mike D'Souza, guitar from Ian Armstrong, vocals by Amy and Katie, and also guitar by Andy Middleton, who I forgot about when I talked about this on the radio show the other day. So I'm sorry, Andy, your part is very well appreciated. But really, the main thanks here has to go to Ryan Harvey. Ryan, who you've heard on loads of times on this podcast, he worked really, really hard mixing the whole thing. Really difficult when you've got all these different vocals and instrument lines coming from, you know, different countries and different people to mix them all together. He did an incredible job. And not only that, he's put a really good video together for it as well. So, yeah, if you check out the link in the description, there's also a link to that video on YouTube as well. So yeah, thanks everyone, especially Ryan. Hope you guys enjoy this. This is Acquiesce by the Oasis Podcast Players. After that, we'll have Alan McGee, and then after that, we'll have Richard Bowes.
See a light that shines behind your eyes.
Right. Welcome back to the Oasis podcast. Alan McGee. How you doing, Alan?
Hey, James. How you doing?
Very good, mate. Very good. Busy couple of months for you. A little film came out. How's it been?
I'm just at that point now that, you know, England's kind of the films come out. I haven't seen streaming figures. I'm told by Sky, told the producer that their quote was, "We are very, very, very happy." So I suspect that means it's really done well, you know, figures wise. It feels like that, the amount of attention it got. And then we start the whole thing again. It comes out on the 15th in 12 or 13 days in Australia. And I'm about to do about 10 days full on press there, like Q&As, online premieres, all that sort of stuff. So it feels good. And then it's a... there's a sort of bidding war in America for the film now because it's done well in England. So it's like, it's kind of in an interesting place, man. You know, I mean, I've talked to you a lot about the film, you know, when I've hung out with you and also on your different interviews that I've talked to you. Yeah, listen, man, it's an amazing film. It's a funny film, isn't it? Near to the truth of the way it went down is debatable, but it's a really funny film, you know.
But did you mind that? I suppose you were, how much no. were you kind of overseeing it and saying, well, no, that didn't happen like that, Irvin, or, you know, or were you just having to just write the story, you know?
I just let him run with it, man. I mean, for better or for worse, there's a couple of things I took out, but other than that, I mean, like things like I never missed any train to Glasgow to sign Oasis. I was chasing a girl, Debbie Turner, but at the end of the day, I'd let him tell the story because it's a kind of, at the end of the day, I did go to Glasgow, I did sign Oasis and they did blow up, and that's factually correct. It's just how we get to that part is just Irvin, you know.
Yeah, a bit of creative license, and it works really well. As I love the you see the same train guy a couple of times, and you know, that's a lovely flourish, even if it is bollocks.
Do you know what the thing is, James? What I'm starting to get my head around is, because the film's going to, I think the film's going to do well in every country. The way that it's went down in the film is the way it's all, and like, and I'm not just talking about Oasis, my everything. That's now going to become what people think happened.
It is. It's weird. You know what? I was just thinking about like King Arthur and Robin Hood. You know what I mean? That all these legends that you know, then it's the way it gets retold and retold, and in fact is like the later telling of it. You're like a modern day Arthurian legend, Alan.
Yeah, I couldn't really be any happier the way it ended up happening, you know, because even coming out in lockdown, I think why we benefited from that, believe it or not, was I think if people had to pay 15 quid, they might have went, I don't know, at a cinema. But because it was like in lockdown, it's £7.99 to watch it on now. And I think a lot of people just went, oh, do you know what? It might be good. And it is really good. And then once they watch it, I'm getting loads of messages off of people going, I've watched it two or three times, you know?
Yeah, it definitely warrants rewatching. I mean, for me as an Oasis geek and as a Creation Records geek, it was, you know, rewatching to try and catch all the cameos. So, you know, we've got Paul Gallagher's in there if you've got your eagle eyes, you've got a couple of Libertines in there if you've got eagle eyes. How did that all go about? Was it you just sort of having a chat with a few people, say, oh, pop down if you get a minute?
That was mainly Shelley, and like we're all friends, we collectively, me and Shelley and Irvin are friends with loads of people, and different people would ask to be in it. Carl Barat wanted to be in it. Gary wanted to be, Gary the Libertines drummer wanted to be in it. Paul Gallagher got asked to be in it, but he wanted, but Brick Smith asked to be in it. You know, I could go right down a big list of people that just all have, yeah, as you say, you know, just jumping in, and it is, they're only in it for like 20 seconds, but you know, they're in it, and there's a load of that going on, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. Is it weird watching it? Is it weird sort of seeing like the portrayal of all the these different people in your life, especially the family stuff as well? Is it strange watching it, or can you kind of step away from it?
I think I'm fine with it. The family stuff I'm completely fine with. It's sort of weird being so center stage at the moment. You know, that's a little bit weird. Do you know what I mean? You know, You know what I mean? Because I'm usually slightly to the left of people, just managing people. Do you know what I mean? And suddenly I'm the story at the moment, but I'm sure it'll pass eventually. Do you know what I mean? I mean, let the film come out everywhere and it'll pass. You know, England's, you know, it's come out in England. It's been successful. People love it. And, you know, it's not like, it's not too big that, you know, it's interfered with anything. So it's fine, you know?
Got you. Got you. No, that's cool. And I mean, there's some great bits in there that I really loved. You know, like a real few standout scenes for me, like the Jason Isaacs, you know, on that mad day around like LA and playing this other film exec, you know, is that based on a real person or an amalgamation of people? Because that guy can't be real, right?
Well, it's not to answer the question, is it Irvin Welsh's imagination, the character? But that kind of person exists in Los Angeles every day of the week. Do you know what I mean? Like a kind of like Sloaney would be royal kind of aristocratic guy in the entertainment business, slumming it with people like me. And that's that's just a character that Irvin's created, to be honest, James. And you know, he's a very funny character, but, you know, I wouldn't necessarily be hanging out with him, do you know what I mean?
Fair enough.
Irvin might have hung out with something like that, you know, if the cocaine was right.
Got you. And what about, like, the sort of the more kind of surreal flourishes, stuff like the Aleister Crowley stuff and the hotel room being on fire and all that kind of stuff? I thought that was it really brought that mad sort of Trainspotting kind of, you know, British cinema vibe to it. But it's it was definitely an interesting choice.
I've never met Aleister Crowley in the bathroom. I mean, it's just Irvin, you know what I mean, you know.
Fair enough. Well, Alan, I really, really enjoyed it. I think that like obviously from the Oasis side of it, you know, it's a tricky one because, you know, while Oasis was a very, very significant part of obviously your story, ultimately, you know, you like it, as you see in the film, you're there to sign them and then you're there to see this big sudden rise. But then you obviously your issues get in the way of it and you're not there for a lot of it. And so it's...
Oh, no, but James, the truth is I wasn't there for 6 months. If you listen to Noel Gallagher, he thinks I was away for 3 years. Do you know what I mean? You know, that's just Noel's interpretation. See, when there's one of the documentaries, you'll love this, right? When when he's talking something, and he goes, "Oh, and he Dick Green brought down some other fucking idiot, like because McGee was in rehab. Do you know who the other idiot was? Me. He doesn't remember it was me." So it's kind of funny. It's just that's the way that story's ended up being told, and I usually don't contradict that. Because it's Nolan as go, that's his story ultimately. If he wants to remember it that way, he can. But when the people are asking me about my life and going, oh, you know, like you just said, oh, you were away for 3 years or 2 years. No, I wasn't. I was away for 6 months. If you want exact dates, from about February 1994, I got ill and I was back September, October.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And what about that actual scene, that the King Tut scene? Did that play out pretty much like you remember it?
Just about, but it wasn't quite actually. I mean, there was no punch up. There was just a lot of kind of like there was a lot of posturing by Oasis, and the security were literally was one or two security guys, and there was about 12 of them. So it was going to be difficult without some kind of altercation for it. So it, you know, not to happen. So it was easier just to let them go and do four songs, and that's how they got on the stage. You know. What was that sound? Round your brain. Today was just a blur. You got ahead like a ghost train. You're the outcast. You're the underclass. But you don't care. Because you're living fast.
Oh yeah, before I forget, just talking about, you know, a random person that's come into your life and out of your life again. When I interviewed Charlotte Marioneur, you know, who's now plays Scissors with Noel Gallagher's band, I had no idea. You signed her like 15 years ago or something.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, she's great, man.
She said, because she's a non-musician, but did you just think, wow, what an interesting character?
She had tunes. The single that I put out, I can't remember what it's called, but it was a great single. I just go on the music, James, ultimately, if somebody's got the tunes. And she was an interesting person, and she had a good tune. And I thought, I'll just put your record out. And she had some good people behind her. Kevin Shields was really tight with her. So it was always going to be a good record, you know.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it was through, you know, Kevin, and then through multiple other people that she ends up then doing that bit of spoken word on Noel's song. And then Now she's been the touring band, and that whole Scissors thing that ended up being a massive deal. And that's, it's just what these weird sort of sliding doors sort of situations, isn't it? That if you hadn't done that 15 years ago and however much it was, then maybe that wouldn't have played out like that. It's funny that the way these things happen, isn't it?
Yeah, she's cool. She's actually a good person.
So should we talk about The Verve then, Richard?
Oh, well, let's. Do you know I've written a book on them, actually?
You have written a book on them, available from no good bookstores.
No, sadly not quite yet. Online through Amazon only, unfortunately, but hey-ho.
I think it'd be cool, though. So these, I love the fact they're all colour-coded and they've all got that same... People haven't seen it. I mean, you'll be able to see the link in the description of this episode. But yeah, so they've all got the same kind of vibe about them. It's a really nice little series. I can imagine them, you know, having them all lined up on your shelf, having the whole set. I think that'd be a cool little set to have.
Yeah, I think that's the idea behind it. You know, it's not not dissimilar to like 33 and a third, you know, those book series. I kind of have uniformity across the branding and the design for it. So as you say, to be a nice little kind of bookshelf thing. And I was very pleased with the cover of my book. You know, I just spoke to the designer and I said he gave me a choice about the color I would want, and that was it. I was like, I see it being kind of khaki green. I don't know why I kind of think of the Verve like that. And then he just kind of came back, and within half an hour he put that up, and it was, I love it. I think it's really good because you can they're instantly recognizable as well, which obviously was handy. And the series as well, the series is developed. The next one's coming out after this is Suede, and then it's gonna move beyond 90s now. I think there's maybe a Radiohead one in the offing, but I think thereafter it's gonna expand a little bit more to kind of broaden it out, so it's not just 90s bands. It's gonna go sort of back further and further ahead as well. It's not even half the size of some might say, and obviously it doesn't have the podcast interviews in it. So it's very much a kind of an overview timeline, in similar to what I did in Some Might Say, but slightly less detailed because I had a word count to hit or to ensure that I couldn't go over. They're 50,000 words. You know, they're by no means the most exhaustive books you'll find on any of the bands, but they're designed to kind of give a good overview. And the actual USP of the series is that it's designed to be kind of through the prism of their chart performance of the bands that are involved. With The Verve, it was slightly trickier because the one before was The Manics, and they've had well over 40 singles. The Verve's slightly difficult because they had a total of 14. It's about, for me, I decided to take the option of, okay, let's go a little bit more into a bit more detail about how they got to where they, you know, what they were doing at the time and the kind of context around it. And obviously they crossed paths with Oasis on numerous occasions.
Mm. So that was the funny one. So taking it back to the start, I was thinking, like, I'm sure that maybe did Brian Cannon introduce them? Because, you know, because obviously Brian Cannon did their artwork from the early days, didn't he? I'm sure Brian Cannon. So, and I messaged you and I said, was it Brian Cannon that introduced them? I couldn't remember if he'd said it on the podcast to me or if he said it to someone else. And I said, you know what? Sorry, I'll just at him because Brian's brilliant on Twitter. And I said, Brian, did you introduce Richard and Noel? Yes, I did. Ah, great. So what's your so tell us about like the forming of the Verve and then the first time that kind of the Oasis and Verve come together.
So Verve, the four lads met at college, Richard Ashcroft, Nick McCabe, Simon Tong, Pete Salisbury. They got the band together. They were quite quickly signed by Hut Recordings. The way they met Brian Cannon, essentially what had happened was Brian Cannon met Richard Ashcroft at a party, and they were both very early on in their careers, and they both said, what did the other one do? And Richard Ashcroft was like, I want to be in a band. And Brian Cannon says, I want to design sleeves for bands. And then a few years later, you know, they went their own ways. And a few years later, I believe it was at a petrol station, they ran into each other again, and the conversation started up again. And Ashcroft was like, do you want to do, you know, we've just been signed, do you want to do our artwork? And then, yeah, as you say, he did all of their, their first three albums, all the artwork surrounding those. So all the singles and everything. Apparently the legend goes that, I don't know the exact context, but yeah, he played Richard Ashcroft, the live demonstration tape, which had, but the, specifically the story goes that he played Richard Ashcroft Live Forever and blew his mind, and then they were introduced and then, yeah, became very firm friends. Maybe I don't really want to know how your garden grows, because I just want to fly. Late 93, Oasis supported Verve, and then they became good pals from then, essentially. There was also that famous night at the Newcastle Riverside where the power went out, and I think it was Ashcroft and Noel sang She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain a cappella while Bono playing the spoons while the power was out. It seems they just really, really bonded from then. In 94, they played the Holstfred Festival with Primal Scream. Oh, no, that was it. The Verve and Oasis were playing the Holstfred Festival, and Primal Scream were also playing, and the three bands were staying in the same hotel. Carnage ensued. And that's where the story about apparently they were the hotel got essentially shut the bar. Primal Scream disappeared to leave Oasis and the Verve with the bill. And then so determined were they to get booze that Richard Ashcroft and Noel broke into a local church so they could get some communion wine, apparently. But, so that's the legend. I don't know whether that's true, but it's a great part of the legend. It's interesting going back and because I'm the early Verve stuff. I really like the music, but I never really, obviously I was a little bit too young to really kind of appreciate it, know about the interviews and stuff like that. So I went back, obviously in research for the book, went back and had a look. And it's interesting how much Ashcroft is very much like Liam and Noel were, you know, before they were out. You know, he was very, very confident, very you know, bordering on arrogant, but very much like, you know, we believe we're the best. You know, we're doing it to be the best. What's the point? Which, you know, given they were kind of around shoegaze, you know, was quite unique at that time. Mm. And then thereafter, obviously, they met Liam and Noel, and they were very much on the, you know, obviously, as we know, of the same attitude, and became kind of, well, you know, soul brothers is how they refer to themselves. But it's kind of how it went from there. And
It's really interesting that I think that's the thing, and because he was Mad Richard, right? That's the I suppose it wasn't the done thing to go around saying you're the best band in the world.
At an early age, we've learned to ignore what the press say and get on with it. I think it's like indicative of the times when if someone goes a little wild on stage and puts on a bit of a performance, he's like he isn't mad in brackets, you know? It just shows how banal and boring the rest of the bands are. If someone puts a performance on, they're immediately mad. I've like stopped for a second when we've been playing live and looked out at the crowd, and people aren't, it's not an aesthetic looks thing, it's a feeling. It's a feeling of the music that takes them away, not because someone's got a big pair of lips. It's hideously boring. Might as well go and see old Mick Jagger in his Zimmer frame, you know? If you want to see a big pair of lips, go and watch the Rolling Stones. If you want to see good music, you know, come and watch us.
But not only was that, there was the fact he was almost, I always kind of thought of him as like a Jim Morrison and the Verve being like the Doors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's like this kind of, this guru kind of figure that, you know, with it's the
shamanic almost.
Exactly. Yeah. With this massive ego and the way he sort of rambles and rants both in interviews and on record. It's interesting. I mean, I'm similar to you. I came to them later, like Storm in Heaven completely passed me by. It was only, I think Northern Soul passed me by, to be honest. I think it was only that my mate Rob had a Northern Soul, but I never listened to it. And I remember like hearing History, and I really liked it. I remember hearing On Your Own, and I really liked it, except for the bit at the end when it goes like, laugh,
yeah, when it goes falsetto, yes.
Like, what is that? And to be honest, that kind of put me off them. And I was like, what is that? That's rubbish. And then obviously then the whole Noel Cast No Shadow thing. So I suppose that takes us into, you know, and then from there it's like, okay, I need to give them a listen. So I did then dig into it a bit more, and then obviously then when Urban Hymns happened, that was absolutely massive. But it really feels like going, you know, when I then went back and listened to A Storm in Heaven and stuff, and I do really like A Storm in Heaven, but I'm not like a purist, like people that love the album and they think that's the best album. For me, I always, you know, go for tunes, you know, that's generally what I want. I want either like plaintive emotional ballads, you know, with that actually mean something and, you know, you can really, you know, hang your hat on, or up for it, joyous, fun, exciting. That tends to be my favorite sort of music. Like, you know, like when I've sort of been very clear on this, that Columbia is not one of my favorite Oasis tunes, as you may be aware, has come up a few times. And so A Storm in Heaven, I really like it, but I never really feel the need to stick it on, just because I'm like, yeah, it's cool. It's just a cool kind of washy, you know, sort of mad kind of brilliant psychedelic mess. But there's not enough tunes for me, you know, and I do appreciate that if I probably listen to it a load more. It's like, I don't like Astral Weeks by Van Morrison, but some people are like, oh no, you've got to listen to it, man. You'll really get into it. I'm like, no, can't be asked. But but then when you get into Northern Soul, then it feels like, okay, well now he's, and do you think it is the connection with Oasis that he was like, oh, okay, actually look at what Oasis are doing. I need to sort of expose, you know, go into myself as a songwriter a lot more. Is that fair?
I think it's a little bit too coincidental. I mean, if it wasn't the case, but there's a lot of things to factor in. I mean, there, for one, for up until A Northern Soul, that everything was a band composition. So it was all the Nick, Pete, and Simon would do the music, and Richard Ascroft would more often than not just do like streams of consciousness over, and it, which would then become lyrics as they were jamming. Then prior to their getting into An Northern Soul, they enlisted Owen Morris as producer. So Owen Morris worked with them. I think it was a Rockfield gig. They did the first album at Sawmills, and then they did An Northern Soul at Rockfield. But they kind of started that similar way, like it was done out of organic jams and you know, all sorts of noise. And Owen Morris obviously had his kind of wall of sound thing. But then separately, Richard Ascroft went away and came back to the rest of the band and went, oh, I've written a couple of songs. And the two songs were History and On Your Own. So that's why they're very sonically different for the rest of the album, because the rest of the album are band compositions, whereas those are solely Richard Ascroft. That's not entirely true. Actually, on A Storm in Heaven, they did See You in the Next One, Have a Good Time, the last track on the album. That was also a solo Ascroft composition. But right. But it was under the guise of the band, whereas this one, these were explicitly his songs. What I was going to say, actually, going just as a brief digression, if you listen to the acoustic version of On Your Own, which is a B-side to History, it's not quite acoustic, but it doesn't have that little falsetto Ascroft bit you were mentioning then, and it's so much better, in my opinion. Okay. just as a little tip for you.
I'll dig that one out.
Yeah, maybe 25 years too late, but... But that alone makes things okay. So they brought in Owen Morris. Well, it can't have escaped their notice that Owen Morris had just produced a very successful album, Indefinitely Maybe. And also, yeah, I think a lot of it was, you know, shrewdly, I think specifically Ascroft, shrewdly thinking, right, these more heartfelt songs are, you know, are popular, are what Oasis have built their success on. There's probably something in this. Although then he then... Before the release of History as a single, he split the band up. Which is a thing. But also, another thing I've forgotten as well, A Northern Soul, one of the theories that goes round to it, and there's a beautiful kind of ambiguity about the birth, they never confirm anything. But one of the theories around the song title was that A, it was, you know, Northern Soul movement, because we, you know, they're from Wigan. Wigan Casino was a big hotspot. But also that... the Northern Soul was Noel when he abandoned the band after the Whiskey A Go Go gig.
Sure.
And the kind of the narrative of the album is that it's a Northern Soul kind of travelling, you know, or it could be Ascroft himself. You know, there is a Northern Soul has actually got a lot of links, who thinks with Oasis, and a school of thought goes is that the reason Noel dedicated Cast No Shadow to Ascroft is because Ascroft is dedicated Northern Soul to him.
So it's
kind of like, it was like a, you know, a tip of the hat back at him kind of thing.
No, I think so. It's interesting, isn't it, when you think about the key people involved? Yeah, Cannon doing the artwork and then Owen Morris producing. It's like, yeah, it's like you know, if they were on Creation as well with McGee, then it would have been like the Holy Trinity of made those key years. But I think the it almost reminds me of you know, the way the Beatles and the Beach Boys were in opposition in the 60s. Mm. you know, there's the brilliant story of like Brian Wilson, you know, listening to Rubber Soul and being like blown away by it, and then so doing Pet Sounds, and the Beatles were blown away by that and did Revolver, and then he listened to Revolver and just went, oh shit, and then so and then went off and like went a bit mad and tried to do Smiley Smile, and then tried to do Smile, which then like, you know, got thrown away and became Smiley Smile, which was a, you know, a mess. And in the meantime, the Beatles do Pepper, and he's like, oh God, yeah, guys, yeah, come on. So, and it did feel a bit like that. Like, you know, it starts off the verve of the big boys, Oasis supporting them, but then Oasis take this leap with Definitely Maybe. So now they're the big boys, and then Verve are like, oh, a bit in there in the background. And then obviously they split up. And then Oasis hit massive with What's Story Morning Glory. And while the Verve are nowhere to be seen. And then when they then come back, you know, they knock Be Here Now off number one, and with Urban Hymns, and then all the end of year accolades go to Urban Hymns as like best album of the year, when Be Here Now should have been the best album of the year. That was when Oasis were at their peak. So, you know, yeah, this really fun sort of back and forth, and actually it's the whole Blur Oasis thing. It was really, for a lot of people, it was Oasis and the Verve, like in, especially when it got to like 96, 97, 98, that was really the battle, not Oasis and Blur.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, the enemy tried to, when the Verve supported Oasis at Earls Court in September or autumn 1997, you know, the enemy tried to make it about other bands' thing. And it's like, well, one supporting the other. So it's not going to be too much. But, that was where the Verve were. You know, Jocks Don't Work had just been number one. They were not necessarily at parity, as close as anyone to Oasis. Just going back a bit, actually, one other thing I wanted to mention about Cast No Shadow. Cast No Shadow, it, once again, as we know, is dedicated to the eternal genius of Richard Ashcroft. Also sounds a lot like a certain Verve B-side called I See the Door. Which, there's a melody bit in that which sounds not wholly dissimilar as well, which I noticed, which is quite interesting. Again, there's a kind of school of thought that the Verve actually captured the mood of the nation after Princess Diana died, in a way that made Oasis seem extremely out of step. You know, there was, you know, because that was Be Here Now was what, out for what, 10 days before Princess Diana died, was killed or died, yeah, or however it was. But then Jocks Don't Work came out the day afterwards, and there is, again, kind of a weird kind of, if you want to view it through that kind of prism of so far apart but also very closely aligned as well between the two acts.
Yeah, very much. It's really interesting, isn't it, that, you know, and then obviously the Britpop, you know, a lot of people sort of pinpoint that as the death of Britpop was the death of Princess Diana. I mean, not that most of us gave a shit about Princess Diana at all, but, you know, it did feel like, you know, it sort of tied in with everything else sort of dying down around that time, and the music changing, so it was a bit more contemplative, and everyone that had that, you know, everyone was doing Come Down albums, and Urban Hymns has got some big brash moments, but it is, a lot of it is a Come Down, you know, Come Down kind of album. Interestingly that you know, that Ashcroft has said that really he views it as his first solo album, and he what was it, he said something like, you know, I bottled it. It should have been my solo album, but really he's phoned, because it was at Salisbury that had stayed with him anyway. And then really just phoned Nick McCabe. He kind of bottled it a bit and was like, come and put some guitar on it, Nick. And so, you know, and so it really is an Ashcroft solo album with Nick McCabe's guitar over the top of it. And I mean, Nick McCabe is a brilliant guitar player. I absolutely think he brings so much to it that, you know, the Ashcroft solo albums definitely are missing. But yeah, I think he's great. What he, you know, what he manages to bring. But it's interesting that, isn't it? I didn't, only doing research for this, I'd really thought about that. I'm like, oh yeah, it is. This is a collection of songs. There's a few tunes like Neon Wilderness and that have got still got that kind of early Verb, you know, band vibe. But yeah, a lot of it is basically an Ashcroft solo album, really, without McCabe's guitar.
Yeah, massively. Yeah, I mean, this is why I find them so fascinating, because that nothing about it really makes sense. So yeah, Ashcroft split up the bands because he was obviously confident about having history and on your own. He thought, okay, I'm able to write songs. Split the band, but it quickly became apparent that what he was actually doing was like moving Nick McCabe out. So he kept on both Pete Selsby and Simon Jones, and then also enlisted Simon Tong because they needed a new guitarist, obviously, because they had Nick McCabe. But it was kind of still going to be, it was looking like it was going to be Ashcroft solo, just with a rhythm section who, you know, happened to be in his former band. Ashcroft worked, they briefly worked with John Squire, they briefly worked with Bernard Butler, but they couldn't replace Nick McCabe. All the while, Ashcroft went through a massive, real splurge of songwriting. You know, he wrote, you're absolutely right, Urban Hymns, 10 of the tracks on Urban Hymns are sole Richard Ashcroft compositions, apart from The Rolling People, Neil Mildis, Come On, and Catching the Butterfly as well, actually. So that's more than, it's a massive part of it. I think it's 9 songs, actually. A massive part of Urban Hymns is Ashcroft solo. But it goes really well. The sessions are going really well. You know, they've got youth into production who, having just come back from working, having just finished working for McCartney, it seems to be going quite well. But in Ashcroft's head, it's missing something. So he just bites the bullet and phones Nick McCabe and said, look, I think it's missing you. Can you come back? And, you know, Nick McCabe comes back in and effectively adds sprinkles to the album, really. I mean, he adds loads to it. Let's not be fair. But with the added dimension of Simon Tong thrown in, it's a lot harder to differentiate as to who is who, as the two kind of lead guitarists. I mean, Simon Tong also does keys and stuff. But yeah, essentially, yeah, McCabe, they resurrect a few old songs and write a couple of new ones. But yeah, it's McCabe coming in and adding, sprinkles to Ashcroft's work. So in some of the research I did, in some of the books I read, they kind of list that they think effectively a band always works better than a solo artist and is always going to be more successful than a solo artist. And that might have been what Ashcroft's thinking was. I personally think, and also History was their best selling single, was their best performing single, and they'd always split up. So I think they had something, you know, to build on there as well. It's again, that's why it's kind of fascinating. You've got a real transition for the first three albums, a complete band one, you know, a by and large a band one with a couple of Ashcroft solo songs, and then a pretty much an 80% or whatever Ashcroft done out album. You wonder how the dynamics, the politics, what's the works within that, which might explain why they kept on splitting up, I guess.
Yeah, and especially when you look at something like the Bittersweet Symphony video, it's Ashcroft. This is Ashcroft stood there charging through. And, you know, and literally bulldozing everyone in his path. And what an iconic kind of moment that is of the 90s. And then it's only at the end that the four little Verve guys charge in behind him. You know, for that. But they're, you know, Ashcroft's because he's so tall and he's just got, you know, and the other guys are sort of shuffling along after him, looking pretty conspicuous. And you're like, okay, this is a rich, this is Ashcroft now.
Yeah.
You know, this is his thing. But one of the things talking about, you mentioned Come On. There's that famous photo of Liam and Ashcroft singing together. And apparently he's on it. Apparently Liam's on it, but can you hear it?
Well, yeah, we touched on this with the collaboration thing, didn't we? No, I still can't. And I've obviously listened to the Verb and that track a lot over the last few months. I still can't hear it. I mean, there's proper like banshee wails going on in the background. Like he's not even singing, it's just noise, which I think is Liam, because it's certainly not, well, I don't think it's Liam doing the singing. But then again, that picture we spoke about, like, that, I'm sure that's in Abbey Road, which I don't think Urban Hymns was done for. But Liam does hand claps on History, which was done in Abbey Road. Although I don't think that photograph is from like 95, to be fair. Liam looks a little bit older than that. A couple of digressions there. But yeah, I still can't hear Liam Gallagher on that bloody record. And I've been trying a lot, but I still can't.
Liam does hand claps on History.
Mm-hmm.
Have I missed that? Yep. I've missed that.
Yeah, and Brian Callan as well. They did it at Abbey Road. They got the London Metropolitan Orchestra in, and it was a bit of a party atmosphere. And yeah, Liam does hand claps on it.
Wow. Is he credited?
I don't know, to be honest.
All right. Well, there we go. That would have come up on our collaborations, didn't it? I mean, it's a pretty minor collaboration. If you just clap his hands.
It's quite niche. I'm going to Google it now, see if he's credited. I wander lonely streets behind where the old Thames flow, and in every face I meet reminds me of what I have run for. According to Wikipedia, the clapping featured on History was performed by Liam Gallagher, although it does then say citation needed.
Oh, okay. I don't think it's on the actual credits.
I don't think so, no.
No. And you mentioned in your notes that Liam loves space and time. Has that been quoted somewhere? I don't remember hearing that.
Yeah, okay. I mean, well, Ashcroft, this was in 96 when the Verve split up. Ashcroft supported Oasis in the States. I think it was like March in the lead up, well, before they'd come back to the main road. And I think he might be, I can't remember where I read it now, but yeah, Richard Ashcroft played, bear in mind, none of these have been released. He played Space and Time, Sonnet, and I think it was a Joyce Didn't Work he played. Apparently Liam Gallagher was like Space and Time. He said that was one of his favourite ever Richard Ashcroft songs at the time. He was, I believe he said from the stage at that gig, Richard Ashcroft, sort yourself out. so along those lines, like get sort it out. Liam's a huge fan of that. I don't think, he doesn't perform it or anything, but reportedly he was a huge fan of that song.
Cool. Well, it's a great song. That's one of my favourites, actually. Yeah. I love Space and Time and Weeping Willow. I mean, Sonnet, like, going back to, like, the whole Richard by himself thing, well, yeah, I mean, like, Lucky Man, he's entirely by himself. I don't think the other guys are in the video. Sonnet, I don't think the other guys are in the video.
In Lucky Man, they are in the video, but it's basically like Richard Ashcroft performing to a crowd of four, i.e. the rest of the band.
They're all just sat there.
Yeah, there was, like, Pete Salisbury gamely like plays a tambourine, but that's about it. Like, they are literally just sitting around this big room. It's quite funny. Happiness, more or less, it's just a change in me, something in my liberty on my mind. Happiness coming and going, I watch you look at me, watch my fever growing, I know just where I am. But how many corners do I have to turn? How many times do I have to learn? All the love I have is in my mind. So
the Verve, so Ashcroft had supported them solo in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, just 97, one thing. Just one gig, I think.
Yeah, just the one gig. And then the Verve then support Oasis at Earl's Court, right? But not the famous There and Then show, the 97 Earl's Court show.
Yes, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So that's then, but then we've got obviously then then Urban Hymns becomes massive. I mean, like, Oasis never supported the Verve, but the around that, you know, the High Hall when they played that, I mean, they were as big as Oasis at that point, I'd say. You know, they definitely, it swung the other way, I think, at that point.
Yeah, I agree. I think you could probably make that argument. I mean, yeah, I just remember Sonnet being absolutely everywhere. It wasn't officially released, it was released as like a 12-inch single only, and because the Verve, that's another good interesting thing about the Verve. They're very protective about not ripping their fans off. Like, they went into the studio with only two songs written for their first album, but they, because they used up all the others for the singles, but they refused to include any tracks like that. So they're insistent upon making not ripping the fans off and doing new music. And they didn't want to release a fourth single from Urban Hymns, but the label was kind of, you know, they had this huge selling album. They wanted to milk it for what it was worth. But the Verve were like, well, no, what they did is, so they released it in four separate 12-inch vinyls to make it ineligible for the charts. Although, yeah, just because they were quite difficult. But yeah, I just remember that Sonnet being everywhere that kind of that spring. And yeah, you look at Hey Hall, and again, watching the Hey or High Hall, however you say it, gig. Yeah, it's an equivalent to the main road gig. You know, it's a big homecoming show to 30-odd thousand people. You know, Brian Cannon calls it the best day of his life because it was his birthday. It's equivalent. Yes, it's as big as, you know, Main Road or the Stone Roses at Heaton Park in terms of those big homecoming shows, definitely.
This is a song called Sonnet.
And then they split again.
So again, it's not fully clear, but Nick McCabe, basically, he was struggling with his mental health effectively and other things, and he didn't want to travel the States because the Verve, because they're not essentially or especially British, they actually had quite a big following over in the States as well, like from the start, really. But he didn't want to. Nick McCabe didn't want to go into all the States, so they brought in BJ Cole, an old steel guitarist who had worked with. I mean, he was in his 50s when the band were in their 20s. I remember I saw them at V98, and it was like this old man sat playing slide guitar, like literally sat down playing slide guitar while a bunch of 20 lads in their 20s were playing music. It was a bit odd. But yeah, they brought him in, but that was just as a touring thing, and then it kind of just fell apart, really. There seems to be kind of long-held issues also between Simon Jones, the bassist, and Rich Dashcroft, which is part of the reason they split the third time back in 2009. So there seems to be some sort of personal thing there, which we don't know the details of. But also, you know, Rich Dashcroft, once again, had a huge amount of songs. He regarded Urban Hymns, as you say, as his first solo album. During the same period as he wrote much of Urban Hymns, he wrote a lot of his debut solo album as well. So he wrote a song for The Lovers and all those, and quite a few other tracks and stuff. So he got quite a lucrative contract from Virgin. He got quite a lucrative solo contract. And then went solo and did his thing. And the associations with Oasis kind of weren't quite so strong then. I think he supported them, Oasis, when they did Old Trafford Cricket Ground, I think, in 2002. I might be wrong there. But the Oasis Association, yeah, kind of dried up a little bit because, you know, the music became unfashionable again. You know, I remember there was a review of in Q magazine of Ashcroft's second album, Human Conditions, which came out about 6 months after Heathen Chemistry. And the review said, oh, this isn't a disaster on the scale of Heathen Chemistry. It's just that from Richard Ashcroft, so much more is expected. I remember word for word, that's what it was.
That kind of sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. But they were still good. I believe they were still good, you know, close friends and comrades and stuff. They weren't quite so cool. Certainly weren't as dominant in the charts at the time.
Mm. You mentioned, I think, at the 2000 V Festival, Noel and Weller and Ashcroft.
Yeah, it's just I recall this story, like, so Rich Dashcroft was headlining, Paul Weller was second on the bill to the headliner, and Weller did what was quite a good set, and that was the incident when at the very end Noel comes on, but the organizers say no, we can't
we haven't got the time. We're like, we literally have no time to do that. Like, so they had to like kick off Noel Gallagher, from stopping performing on the stage with Paul Weller. But Noel kind of said afterwards, he's like, I was relieved because he said in his own words, he was pissed as an arsehole. So he wouldn't be able to do it. He says he can't remember doing it. But I just remember, I remember between the two bands, it's the going, what if like it's, because obviously I knew they were friends, like what if Paul Weller, Noel Gallagher and Rich Ascroft would do like a big thing at the end? Didn't happen. I was furious.
Didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen. I was gutted. But that was just one time that they kind of crossed the paths in the early part of the century, because there wasn't much else. They seemed quite separate. Obviously, in the year 2000, they always had their own things going on.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it, that like there hasn't been a lot of, obviously we've heard about this sort of Boner playing the spoons thing and stuff, but yeah, that Weller, Weller and, when we did the collaborations episode, I mean, bloody how many tracks has Noel played on for Weller? It's like 8 or something, and yet other than indecipherable singing and hand claps, like from Liam, there isn't that same level of collaboration with Ascroft. I wonder if Noel, I mean, even going back to the Matt Morgan podcast yesterday, Noel always, he has such reverence for Weller. He's like, well, he's the boss, isn't he? I can't remember what he's saying, the boss or the, he's the man or whatever. He's like, he looks at him, I suppose he's from that previous generation. Well, Weller's the man. But, Oasis have sold more records than Paul Weller ever sold. Noel Gallagher is held in higher esteem by most people, is more famous than Paul Weller or The Jam, I would say. People might be throwing their phones out the window at that, but I would probably say that, and yet Ascroft, he doesn't seem to have that reverence. Maybe it's because they're sort of that similar generation that he's not like, he'll come and guest on Weller stuff all the time. I think probably because he's got that reverence for him in a way that maybe, maybe their paths just don't cross. I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think in Ascroft's case, he doesn't really collaborate. I mean, he has a lot of musicians he works with have worked with a lot of other people. He had on his first solo album, he had Pino Palladino, who went on to go and step into John Entwistle's shoes and had quite a back issue himself. Brian Wilson's on Ascroft's second album. But broadly, he doesn't really, artistically collaborate on a one-on-one. I think he did it with the Chemical Brothers and he did it with Uncle. But I think those are the only examples. Likes a lot of samples of Ascroft, but I think he likes the whole project to be his.
Yeah.
When Noel came back with Chasing Yesterday in 2015, it came up in a few interviews about, would you be interested in working with Richard Ascroft? And he said, Noel was like, yeah, I'd be up for that. I love United Nations of Sound, which is Ascroft's most recent album, also his worst in my opinion. But he was like, oh, that was, I'd be up for doing that. And the following year when Ascroft returned, and this is where I think I often feel quite bad for Richard Ascroft, because he always gets asked about the Gallagher brothers. Always, every single interview, he will always be asked about the Gallagher brothers. Obviously, Liam and Noel don't get that. They don't get asked about Richard Ascroft. I suppose it's similar to what you were saying about Weller as well. Weller will probably sometimes be asked. Well, not, I doubt it's as much as with Ascroft, but he'll often be asked about Noel. So the following year, like Ascroft was saying, well, I'm best friends with both of them. I'm like, I'm like the third brother. I would love to work with Noel because we're both great songwriters, but I don't want to annoy Liam.
In an ideal world, I just think it'd be a sensational record, but unfortunately, I have a deep respect and love for his brother, and I think it'd upset Liam a lot.
That precludes you from it, does it?
Pardon?
That precludes you from it in your mind.
Yeah, well, that's different, because brother type thing is different, you see. It's like a mafia thing, isn't it? I'm really going to stick in the middle of those two brothers with a Noel and Richard Ascroft album, watch Liam. Like, think of Liam festering listening to it on the radio. I don't think so. I'd be really excited about helping Liam get his first. I think Liam should do his first solo album.
Shortly after that, and touching on Weller, Noel somehow managed to royally annoy Richard Ascroft through quite an odd move. I still don't really understand what Noel was playing at then with his comment about how he, Weller, and Johnny Marr were the only songwriters in the country. Everyone else, including Richard Ascroft, was using a team of songwriters.
I write, that's it. I'm not interested in writing with anybody else, unless we're going to start a new band. You know what I mean? I am offended by singer-songwriters who, when you scratch the surface, actually don't do any fucking songwriting. I'm offended by that. As far as I can be aware, you scratch the surface of any fucking solo artist in this country, they've all got a team of songwriters behind them, apart from me, Weller, and Johnny Marr. I'm struggling to think of anybody else. Ashcroft, Arkid, all the way to fucking Ed Sheeran and any other cunt you can fucking... The little fella out of fucking One Direction. They've all got an army of songwriters behind them, you know what I mean? And that's all right, you know.
You prefer to be the lone wolf?
No, it's good because it fuels my arrogance, which is good for me.
We wouldn't have it any other way.
No, but I'm not... I think it's important that as a solo artist, it's coming from you. Or else what is it? What is it? It's someone else's melodies and someone else's words. I'm struggling to think of anybody else.
The interview was around Christmas 2017. It was for the Soda Jerker podcast. And one of the questions is, yeah, what do you think about team of, you know, army of songwriters? And Noel gets on his high horse and he's like, I'm offended by that. I'm offended by anyone who needs an army of songwriters. Yeah, this is the army of songwriters thing. He's like, I'm offended by that. You know, and it seems everyone in the country is doing it. You know, I can only think of me, Weller, and Johnny Marr are the only songwriters left. Everyone from Ed Sheeran, Ashcroft, our kids, to the little bleep from One Direction. So he did specifically mention Ashcroft to that bit. But yeah, so that was like late December, or just around about December 2017. But yeah, Liam tweeted, dig me out all you want, our kid, but Richard Ashcroft pisses all over you, or something like that. And then Ashcroft jumps in with, I don't write my own songs. Do you want to qualify that, NG? ?
Yeah.
And then I don't think there was any more kind of fallout from that. But it's just I do mention this in the book. I don't know why Noel did that, because Richard Ashcroft does, there are a few kind of co-write credits for Richard Ashcroft, because he has used a lot of, on quite a few songs, he's used samples. So within that, you kind of, like his song Music is Power, it uses a sample of a Curtis Mayfield written song. So it's credited to Ashcroft Mayfield, you know, obviously, and we all know about the Bittersweet Symphony saga.
Sure.
But that aside, you know, he doesn't actively work with other people. So I don't know where Noel's got that information from. It seemed a bit odd. But yeah, that properly drove the divide that made Ashcroft, you know, team Liam. Absolutely. You know, Ashcroft was, when he was interviewed around about sort of 2016, he was hedging. He was making a point of saying he was friends with both of them. Whereas now he's very much, you know, he and Liam have toured America, and obviously he did that surprise slot at Finsbury Park and Manchester and stuff. He's very much team Liam now.
Yeah, that was exciting. I did really enjoy that, seeing him at Finsbury Park. I've seen him. I never saw The Verve. I saw Ashcroft solo a couple of times. I think once on the Alone with Everybody at Brixton, and once with Human Conditions, and I thought it was great. Like, you know, he has got that shamanistic thing, isn't he? That he can just drive a crowd. He can get you in that moment when you're in a gig and you kind of lose yourself and you're just lost in the music. I think he can do that. In a way that not many people can. He's got that magic about him. And it was really cool to see him out on the guitar, but with Liam's thing. But what my one criticism of Ashcroft as a songwriter, and I think this is where he would be better if he had a collaborator to like rein him in a little bit, is he really does love that, like, you know, doing another take with a vocal. So he'll do one where he's just going, I know, I know, I know, I know, and then he'll do you can imagine the record. Yeah, I think we got it, Richard. Oh, got another one. Wah, wah.
Yeah.
Oh, all right, we got it now, Richard. No, I've got another one. Oh, yeah, he's just got, it's like, okay, mate, you don't need to keep going with that. You know what I mean? I think that if you listen out for that, then that kind of spoils it. And I think one of I might have said it on this, when I watched him at Finsbury Park, I sort of thought, like, he was brilliant, but because he played like the full versions of the songs with all those like rambly bits at the end of all the songs. And mm-hmm. so he only got to play like five. I think if he just cut them all short, like just played like the chorus and the verse and the chorus, he could have played another three songs, but he had to do all of the like all of the like the random rambly bits at the end of the songs.
Yeah, he does. Well, yeah, he uses his voice as an instrument, you know, in the truest possible way. And yeah, let's be fair, it's a fantastic voice. You know, I'd put him in the ring for certainly one of the best 96 singers of the 90s. But yeah, you're right. He does. I mean, like, and Urban Hymn specifically. Well, actually, no, all his work since then. So you're right. There's been so many different layers of like different harmonies and different where he's kind of done the vocal. Yeah, where he's used the vocals. You know, and then, drowned it, I think I referred to it as drenched it in his vocals. Yeah, I know what you mean. It can get a bit much. The thing is, I think he's quite a good approximation of Liam and Noel. And this is kind of, this is a point that other people have made that I can't take credit for. He's got the songwriting of Noel, but he's got the charisma of Liam, you know, and that's kind of, that he is, like you were saying a minute ago, he can carry room because he's a born star, you know, in his own way. Yes, you know, he probably did benefit from being very much like Liam and Noel in the 90s, but he doesn't fake it. You know what I mean? He absolutely means it in the same way that Liam does,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he does, you know, let's be fair, he does expose himself to mockery quite a lot because he doesn't take things well, and sometimes he does do things which kind of fall into potentially into pastiche. But he means it, you know. He absolutely means it. And like I say, and similar with Liam, and that's probably why they're mates. You know, I mean, if you could sit and overhear a conversation between the two of them, I imagine it would go exactly as you think it would. Do you know what I mean?
I would love to be a fly on the wall. Imagine that. Imagine the. You know, the conspiracy theories and stuff that would be flying around in that. That would be fascinating. But yeah, I mean, he had that, like, was it the one show a couple of years ago and he was jumping around or like, I think there might've been a couple of interviews and he almost like talks in a sort of a fake American accent as well at times. And you're like, Richard, what are you doing? Like he does really veer into self-parody quite a lot, I think.
When music becomes almost like a religion, yeah? Rock and roll. It's like a religion. So don't ever question one of the key attributes.
Well, and also, I wouldn't. And the other thing I wouldn't question is, I wouldn't question a polo neck either, yeah. Because I'd love to be able to wear a polo neck on set. That'd be
exactly.
Yeah, it would be
well,
nice.
Sometimes, you know, life feels like the Truman
he's
Show.
He's on the moon.
No, check this out. Go life
on,
feels
go
like
on.
The Truman Show.
Yeah.
But I just want to walk, say hello to Manchester. It is the Truman Show.
Yeah.
So,
and there is a back of the sofa. It's a real thing.
So natural rebel and all this, that and the other. It's about breaking the order of things.
This is your new album.
Yeah.
Which has been critically received very, very nicely.
Only by good-looking people. I've never had a bad review off a good-looking person. You know that.
And like we've sort of skipped over the fourth Verve album, fourth. But you know, like there's on that one as well, it does feel like, what was it? I re-listened to it again. This is another similar one, similar to like the way On Your Own kind of put me off. Love Is Noise. I thought it was a really good song, except for that, like, or whatever, that like weird, like
loop,
vocal thing all the way through it. I'm like, oh, and once you hear it, you can't unhear it. And so it kind of like put me off that song because I think it's a great song, but I just find that bit so annoying. And then there's the, what's the tune called? Noise Epic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like Noise Epic, I can imagine the guys have written this really, really cool instrumental. And, you know, like the Storm in Heaven days, they come up with this brilliant jam with a storm, you know, and then the Storm in Heaven days, Richard would come out with something, but it'd be buried in the mix and it'd be cool and interesting and like a rambling kind of shaman. This, he's like effectively rapping in like an American accent. You're like, what are you doing, mate? Like, just shut up. And that's, you know, that really was one of the clunkers I thought of and it spoiled it then. I'm like, you've got the band The Verve, like we're saying, we've got this really cool psychedelic band, and then you've got this kind of great songwriter has these moments where he probably takes it a bit too far. And I thought that was one of those moments, really.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, that is a good example, actually. I mean, I adore Love Is Noise. I think I tend to agree with Noel when he says it might be the best thing they've ever done, in my personal opinion, which is a big shout, and I'm aware I'm in the minority with that. Talking about Noel, I've just gone back through some of Rich Ascroft's tweets, and I forgot about this, but when he was around about the same time, it was May 2019, when Rich Ascroft did a show at Central Park. He said something like a snarly comment about this is about with me, I've done this with my army of songwriters. But he was actually referring to the Rolling Stones British Symphony debacle. So he actually had to put a tweet out afterwards saying, Rich Ascroft has a tweet saying, I was talking about Kline Jr. at Central Park. I have no beef with any musician. Noel G has written some of my favourite songs. Long may he continue. I wish him all the luck in the world. Just to kind of put a pin in that, kind of in that bit of the story. What were we talking about before that? Sorry, I've gone off.
No, I was just saying how Fourth kind of epic noise sort of annoyed me particularly, and it's really high in the mix as well. You know, you can just tell. I just really feel for the other guys that, you know, they've always just gone like, oh, okay, go on then, Richard, do what you want. Like, you know, you can imagine they've worked so hard on this thing, and then Richard's there mumbling in an American accent. Okay. Well, and it goes back to like my thing I was saying about The Doors, you know, like, and a lot of people love Jim Morrison, but a lot of people really hate him, you know, and that he's got that thing. He's almost a parody of himself as well. I think Ashcroft's a better lyricist than, although he has a couple of clunkers, than Morrison. But I think that's like an interesting comparison, I think.
Yeah, they said that they come from kind of, especially if you watch The Verve's kind of early shows. Yeah, he's wafer thin, you know, he's got his long hippie hair, but because he's still quite young. I mean, Richard Ascroft's not 50 yet. You know, he's the last of that generation to even get anywhere near 50. So when The Verve first started, he was like 20. When their first album came out, he was like 22. Obviously, wow. He did a lot of work before that. So he's wafer thin. He looks quite androgynous because of, you know, how in that way that adolescence can make you look like a waif. So yeah, he does kind of carry the sort of the Jim Morrison thing quite a lot. And yeah, he is just wailing into my microphone a little bit as well. So he has that. Yeah, that's the Jim Morrison thing. Definitely a fair comparison. Absolutely.
And yeah, just to finish off, I did ask on Twitter. I asked people to vote for their favourite Verve album. I was surprised, actually. Now, the Oasis podcast fans, you know, I think you'd assume that most of them would be Urban Hymns. And that has played out. So Storm in Heaven got 7%, Northern Soul got 22%, Urban Hymns got 70%, and Fourth got 1%. But then I also did a poll saying, what do you think of Verve, A Storm in Heaven? 35% said Sonic Masterpiece, 29% good, but not enough tunes. I kind of skipped somewhere between those two, by the way. 26% said never really heard it, which I thought was an important one to put in there, because I think a lot of people haven't really dug into it. And then only 10% said not for me, mate, which I thought was interesting. Are you in the Sonic Masterpiece corner there, Richard?
Yeah, definitely. I love it. I mean, I was a relative late, kind of like similar to you. You know, I kind of got into the Verve around history sort of time, and then they split up, so I didn't
bother. So I thought, well, they split up now. What's the point? Then going to Urban Hymns, then went back. And for me, Storm in Heaven was the best one for me. I certainly preferred it to Northern Soul. Not so much now, but I certainly have a massive soft spot for Storm in Heaven. I do think it's a sonic masterpiece, yeah.
Mm. And and it got loads of and like, so I think everyone that has actually heard it, like, I think people that it's one of those that if you've heard it and you're into it, you absolutely love it. So we've got like William McLeish says one of the greatest albums of all time, singles around that period like Gravity Grave and All in the Mind, massively underrated for some reason. And I say this as a huge Oasis fan, Storm in Heaven is just different level to anything Oasis did. The JMC, really decent album. For me, it's the real sound of the Verve. Really great musicianship and songwriting. Album is more cohesive than the other albums as well. B-sides like Man Called Sun are superb. International Superpod, which is our friend Jamie Irwin, who I've done his podcast before. What's your favorite? He's now got a Green Day podcast. If you're into Green Day, check it out. Very underrated, probably because it doesn't have any big singles and it wasn't released before they really hit it big. My friends still laugh about the time I put it on and they thought this is a long opening track when it was about six songs in, but it's a great immersive album. My thinking on A Storm in Heaven, I probably couldn't tell you which songs are which. Like, I know there's the one that's got like the brassy bit and there's the one that's got the flute and there's a bit, but I couldn't tell you, to be honest. Every time I've heard it, his jaw just mashes into one.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, they're the singles that led. Sorry, the singles that were before Storm in Heaven, like All in the Mind, She's a Superstar, and Gravity Grave are quite distinctive. Yeah, I know what you mean with Storm in Heaven. There is. It's also because of the way that it's mixed. Sometimes it kind of. There's a lot of kind of fading into songs and fading out as well, which kind of sometimes does, like some songs go break to an almost like glacial pace and inaudible level before coming back as well, which does kind of add to that, as you say, kind of atmosphere of not necessarily knowing what song is which. But I think, yeah, I think that works to its strength. I think it's kind of a lights out, you know, incense sticks or a light the incense sticks kind of immersive kind of album to sort of let it kind of wash over you, kind of wipe right away.
Mm. And then a couple more comments. We had Patrick Ridge. Urban Hymns is my favorite, but it's a close call between that and the first two. Storm in Heaven is amazing. Northern Soul is dark as hell and sums up where they were at that time. I think the highs of Fourth, Love is Noise, Valium Skies are great too. Not a bad album between them. Wayne Shirley says, played Urban Hymns to death as a teenager, but haven't listened to it for years. I went back and now love those first two, especially Storm in Heaven. I sense Mad Richard got very influenced by Oasis and Britpop, which made the band less exciting after Northern Soul. Wish I saw him live. Who else have we got? Sean McLaughlin says, absolutely love the band and Mad Richard, seen them loads of times with Oasis and on their own, seen Ashcroft solo loads as well, also a huge fan of the legendary Richard Bowes as well, such a talent.
Oh, geezer.
And what was it, what was the other one that was really good? There's a comment that was really good, and here we go. Rudy Abdallah said, very much looking forward to this episode, pre-ordering my copy of Richard's book tomorrow. No music collection is complete without the Verve, Oasis and Stone Roses. Their songs make you feel 10 feet tall. A Storm in Heaven is pick of the bunch, perfect for dreamers, stargazers and sunrise watchers.
Hello, what a line.
Yeah, and you said, very well put, shame it's too late to steal that. And I said, mate, you should have written the book instead.
You're bang on. There's nothing in the good... This is the worst PR you'll ever hear, but there's nothing in the book that's quite so succinct and apt as that. Beautifully put.
It's lovely, isn't it? So, yeah, no prize for Mr. Abdallah. So Richard, what's legacy of the Verve now that they are they're removed. Are they going to get back together? I never asked this question about Oasis, but, you know, I hate it when people go on about that, but with the verb, it's okay. Are they going to get back together? What do you think is going to happen if they don't? Ashcroft's going to carry on going. And generally, what's your thoughts?
I do think, yeah, I think, I mean, it's really hard to tell because they have split up, you know, twice before. Well, three times before, in fact. This is their third split. So it's not necessarily beyond the realms of possibility then to get back together again. Although there has been the longest time now since they, you know, it's been 11 years now. 12 years? Yeah, 12 years now. They had several mediators the first time around. You know, Pete Salisbury was consistently worked with Richard Ashcroft. Even after the birth, he was always his drummer. And then I think he and Nick McKay were talking about doing some work, so it was kind of facilitated that way. They also had a manager, Jazz Summers, who was able to facilitate things. He passed away a few years ago. There is a school of thought, and this is including from Nick McCabe, who thinks that because of... Do you remember when Richard Ashcroft was asked to leave a youth centre because he turned up and he was apparently a bit dishevelled, and he was like trying to motivate these young kids at this youth club, and he had to be asked to leave. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was... So there is a bit of... Well, Nick McCabe has said in interviews that there might have been conversations that were had about your solo career is probably not going to be great now. Do you want to maybe get the band back together? As in, it was a bit of a PR escape. Whether or not that's true, who knows? Because it was a full-blooded commitment from all the bands, so hopefully that's not true. But yeah, I think Rich Ashcroft, I think there was a lot more kind of full stop with the last one. You know, they came back with a good album. They headlined virtually every major festival. You know, they released they from all the gigs, they covered pretty much the whole set. You know, the early comeback gigs were like early material. Then they had the headline festival slots. It had a sense of completion that perhaps might have been an itch that the various members of the band wanted to scratch. So no, I think I can't see it again. But like I say, you know, I think Richard Ashcroft will probably... I think he sees himself and describes himself as a troubadour. You know, I think he will... I think he'll... He a one man his guitar. I think that's kind of how he sees it from now on. And it does all depend on him, really. Mm. But like I say, you know, they have split up several, you know, three times before. So, or twice before this. So who knows?
Who knows? Who knows? Ashcroft might dig out the sparkly cardi again.
He wore that, right? I watched him. He supported Roger Waters the following week, and he wore that then as well.
He loves it.
Loved it.
It's so weird, isn't it? Because normally these big rock stars, like, it's a different, you know, Liam, it's a different Parker. You know, there's ones that kind of get that. He's bloody... He must have six versions of it, so he's always caught one handy. Well, that one absolutely stinks. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, and that was a hot summer as well. The summer of 2018.
Oh, that was a hot dear, summer. Oh, dear. Oh, God. All right. Well, look, Richard, thank you very much for your time. Just tell us again, where can people get hold of this book?
Well, it will be, if you go onto Amazon put in Modern Music Masters, The Verve, you can get it on there. At the moment, it's only available from Amazon. It's available for pre-order as a Kindle hardback or paperback. Just to make it clear, you know, this is very much just my own work. There aren't any pictures or anything like that. So, you know, don't go expecting, some might say, because I didn't have the money for that. But there'll also be, if you go onto my Twitter page, it's the pinned tweet, there'll just be a link on there for which you can... if you purchase it, if you're so inclined. Yeah.
Brilliant. All right, Richard, well, thank you very much for your time. And, I'll tell you what, like the way I, you know, with a proper guest, I get them to pick a favourite Oasis song. What's your favourite Verve song to end with?
Oh, good one. I would like She's a Superstar.
Wonderful. Brilliant. All right, well, we'll end with that. Richard, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, James.
So I hope you guys enjoyed that. Thanks very much again to Richard for taking the time to have a chat through The Verve and Oasis with me, and to McGee earlier, obviously. Make sure you are getting hold of Richard's book on The Verve, Modern Music Masters. It's the link for it is in the description of the episode. And also, as we said, thank you again to Hop Culture Mats for sponsoring the episode and for your chance to get hold of that Oasis-themed set of beer mats. Then tweet at me and at hopculture_mats with your choice for a pun based on Oasis and an alcoholic drink. So really looking forward to hearing some very creative choices there. As I say, don't forget to check out the Mixcloud or Patreon, where I'm doing the Oasis Podcast radio show over there, because there's some, you know, some really cool episodes over there. They've gone up, two went up last week, actually. The one with McGee talking about top 20 creation records, plus also one where I played the best of the guests. And that was like a celebration of the fact that we've done 4 years now of the Oasis Podcast. Yeah, we just had the 4 year anniversary the other day. And so I thought what I'd do is just go through and just play the full songs by people that have been in the podcast. And so told a few stories, remembering some of those cool people that we've had on. So that was really, really nice. So yeah, it would be great if you go and give that a listen. So it just remains for me to say thank you very much for listening to the Oasis Podcast. And most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is, and it's greatly, greatly appreciated. You can become a patron at patreon.com/OasisPod, which is where I post articles, and the episodes always go up early, and bonus episodes. And a few bits that have gone up there recently is I've done 3 different ranking videos. So these will probably go out publicly at some point, but for now they're just going to live over on Patreon. So what I've done is ranking the post-Oasis careers of the different members of Oasis. I've done a ranking of all the Oasis and Gallagher related albums, and I've done a ranking alongside James Hargreaves from the James Hargreaves Guitar Channel. I've done a ranking of every Oasis single, including the B-sides. So, you know, if you're ranking Some Might Say, you're also taking into account Acquiesce and Talk Tonight and that sort of stuff. And that's really cool. That's just gone up on Patreon. So if you want to check that out, then head over to patreon.com/OasisPod, where all that stuff lives. Please give us a review on iTunes if you can, and follow on the socials at Oasis Podcast on Twitter and Facebook, and Oasis Pod on Instagram. You can always drop me an email. It's always great to hear from you, oasispod@gmail.com. And until next time, stay engaged. No, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young. Sod it, let's play it again, shall we? Oasis Podcast Players with Acquiesce, come on!